This is an ABC podcast. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, welcome to The Country Hour this afternoon. I'm Cassie Huff, and there's quite a lot of disappointed farmers out there at the moment, speaking to quite a few about the lack of rainfall that has fallen in this system. I'd be interested to know how things are looking at your place. You can text me on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. I know a lot of farmers across the state and others as well are focused on what the weather's doing right now and what it might mean for their harvest this year. But China has dealt a blow to next year's production, with a number of key Chinese ports no longer able to export fertiliser.
So it's another big issue for us, because, you know, we get more than 60% of our DAP and MAP and about 15% of our urea from China. So we will be looking to alternate origins for large chunks of that.
I'll explain more on what's going on in the next 20 minutes or so. But while I'm talking about the season, it's obviously the time of year when people are starting to ramp up towards harvest. A lot of hard work has gone into growing the crop and getting it off to the silos. The first cab off the rank for Viterra this year is Jeremy Callis from Arno Bay, who deposited a load of peas into the Viterra network this week. Lucas Forbes caught up with Mr. Callis about how his season is faring.
I'm estimating to put about 300 tonne into the Viterra system there at Port Neal.
And what has the season been like for you?
So a quick rundown. We started dry sowing our program on the 6th of April, straight after Easter. We jagged 18 to 20 mil up the coast on a couple of our coastal farms, which germinated our dry-sown peas and a few other crops. However, then we had no more follow-up rain till it broke the season, which was about near the end of May sort of thing. From then on, May or end of May, June, July was quite wet, looking like probably set up for one of our biggest years ever. And then come August, September, was quite disappointing. August and September were well and truly below average for us. Certainly took the cream off the top, that's for sure. So, yeah. We've had about 200 mil over most of our properties, which is, as you know, we're dry land farming at Arno Bay, but we average of about 300 mil. So we're still a 100 mil short sort of thing. So, yeah.
You've actually reduced a lot of your livestock in favour of more cropping. I suppose, seeing this this year, how are you thinking about having fewer or less or no livestock compared to grain?
Yeah, well, I think you guys interviewed me about 3 years ago, and we got absolutely caned with a lot of soil erosion. We cut our sheep right out of the program, which is not great. I quite enjoy livestock, but we sort of chose to go down this avenue just to try and get a bit more cover, and people probably laugh when I say growing peas, but we're reaping them with crop lifters and leaving quite a bit of cover. But yeah, I don't know. I think livestock are definitely good in this business, in this country, but anyway, we'll run with it for a couple of years and see how the all cropping goes, I suppose.
Arno Bay farmer Jeremy Callis speaking there. Well, Teapot CEO Kieran Carville says he's expecting Teapots to receive about 600,000 tonnes in receivables this harvest. Mr. Carville says while Teapots is prepared for the harvest, getting the staff into SA has been a challenge.
It's that time of year again, isn't it? We expect it to be a slower start-up this year with a late harvest. We expect it really only to kick off in earnest in November. We've, in comparison to last year, we have made some expansions to our system. We've built a new bunker site up in Kimba to try and facilitate deliveries from the Kimba and Buckleboo market. We've expanded the site in Lock as well, just finishing up the expansion works at the moment.
How many staff have you found, and is that as many staff as you needed to operate this harvest?
Oh, we need over 100 staff on a casual basis. So we've found the staff. Part of the dilemma is getting them over the borders in time, dealing with quarantine issues, etc., and getting the approvals from SA Health. Now, Primary Industries has, over the last month, taken a much bigger role in sort of a pre-selection work being done by them in support of SA Health to try and cut down timelines. But it is and will remain a challenge.
Sure. So what do you expect to receive in terms of grain receivables this year?
I think, Lucas, we're expecting to see somewhere northwards of 600,000 tonnes, and that's between harvest receivables, post-harvest receivables from the off-peak programme. There's a number of different avenues that we'll see grain coming in through. So we're pretty confident on that number, but you never know until the harvest is over and you count the tons on the stack.
Teaport CEO Kieran Carvel ending that story from Lucas Forbes. The bulk handlers are starting to ramp up their intake for grain. It's only just started, just some peas. There's still a bit to go, but I think with the warm weather forecast for next week, that could speed things up a little as well. Now, I know there's a lot of disappointment across the state after the forecast rain that has fallen or not fallen across the state in the last 24 hours or so. I'd be interested to know how things are looking at your place. Text me on 0467 922 891, or you can call like Phil Cornish from Bordertown has on 1300 222 891. Good afternoon.
Oh, hello, Cass.
How are things looking at your place?
Well, it's not my place, it's my son's place. He's away on holidays, and everything was looking fantastic a couple of days ago until I drove in the through the paddocks this morning, and I thought, oh, that wheat looks a funny colour, and I thought, oh no, don't tell me. Had a closer look, and yeah, the frost has taken it out.
When do you think the damage was done?
A few days ago there was a bad frost at Keith, very low temperatures there, and that must have been the one. So I didn't think it would have done so much damage. You know, there's a reasonable amount of moisture in the ground, but and the crop was looking fantastic, but now...
Gosh, that's the last thing you need.
Hay.
No rain, yeah. And then frost. Did you get any rain in the last couple of days?
Yeah. Oh, yes. We've had 11 mils out of this one, and we've had, we've had good rains. We've had enough to keep it going quite well, so that hasn't been the problem. But, one jolly frost and it's gone.
Yeah, particularly given what the price is at the moment. That must be a blow. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yes, I'm not going to ring my son yet until he gets home. I'll let him have his holiday, I think.
Yeah, break it to him once he's rested and back on the place. Thanks for your call today.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. Hopefully it all comes out. It will. Okay.
Hopefully it's not as bad as you think. Yeah, thanks. That was Phil Cornish from Bordertown speaking about some frosted wheat there, unfortunately. It seems like it really hasn't been a good couple of days for a lot of farmers across the state. And there has also been some not terribly good news out of China as well. With China, some key Chinese ports that will no longer export fertiliser in an effort to keep more of the valuable commodity available to the Chinese farmers. Andrew Whitelaw from Thomas Elder Markets says prices for some fertiliser products have actually tripled in the 12 months, and this news won't do anything to bring those prices down.
But what we're seeing in China, and China is another factor that's coming into play with fertiliser, the Chinese government want to encourage food production locally. They have a mandate for food security, so they want farmers to produce as much as possible. Because energy around the world has gone up, it's meant that there's a really strong export market for Chinese fertiliser. What the Chinese government has done is they've, over the last couple of months, they've enacted sort of changes and new rules bit by bit to limit the amount of fertiliser which leaves Chinese shores. And that sort of hit a crescendo last night when a lot of ports have now banned people bringing in fertiliser into port to export. The reason they're doing that is, well, if they reduce exports to the likes of Australia, then what happens is then that means that fertiliser will become cheaper within China, which will encourage their farmers to buy more fertiliser and then have stronger yields.
So last night, some Chinese ports banned the export of fertiliser from those ports.
That's right, yeah. So it's another big issue for us because, you know, we get more than 60% of our DAP and MAP and about 15% of our urea from China. So we will be looking to alternate origins for large chunks of that.
So if prices are high, that's one thing. It's going to be more expensive for farmers to buy fertiliser and use it. But if there are bans in places from some of our largest sort of suppliers of fertiliser, that's another thing. Are there concerns Australian farmers won't be able to get the fertiliser they need for next crop?
Look, I don't want to scare anyone at this point of the period. We've still got a long time to go before we near a fertiliser. What we find is typically that trade flows change. You know, we've seen it with our barley. We can't send it to China, so we send it to Saudi Arabia. There are alternate origins for our fertiliser. Like, we get most of our urea from the Middle East anyway. We will find alternate options. We'll find alternate origins for the fertiliser. What it's doing is it is meaning that the prices are going to be higher because you've lost a big chunk of supply. And similar actions happening in Russia. Russia is focusing their fertiliser on the domestic farmers to encourage them to grow more.
So is there a date or a month or something that we really should be keeping an eye on in terms of knowing what kind of supply there will be and the ability to get it to Australia in time for the next crop?
Well, the scary thing is that all the reports out of China is that all of this action against fertilizer exports is due to continue right through until June, which, you know, is basically the point of time when Chinese farmers will have purchased all of their requirements. And obviously our import program is due to start ramping up, and we'll obviously be looking to purchase our fertilizer as farmers prior to seeding in a lot of cases. And so, look, I think it is just a case of we will get what we want. We have had issues in the past where there's been concerns. Like last year, we were concerned that we wouldn't get fertiliser because of COVID. We got all we needed, and we managed to actually import quite a substantial volume last year. The market tends to still operate. It's just a case of, you know, our expectations and those of, you know, if you ask any analyst around the world, would be that, you know, fertiliser prices are liable to stay strong.
Andrew Whitelaw from Thomas Elder Market speaking to Warwick Long there. So not good news for next year's crop, but the way this one's tracking as well is a bit up in the air now with this rain not really panning out. Darren Peck is an agronomist at Jamestown with Elders. Good afternoon.
G'day, how are you going?
I'm well, thanks. So I spoke to a lot of agronomists and farmers this morning, many of whom were saying they were too annoyed at the lack of rain in this system to actually speak to me on the radio. How are things looking around your part of the world?
Look, in our area, sort of, I measured about 1.5 mil there where I live at Laura, but sort of heard up to 6, you know, around Crystal Brook, and I think 3 sort of up Blaru way, but that pretty much sums up our spring so far, really.
So would rainfall this week have rescued the season for those crops, or is your area sort of already looking a bit too far gone?
Jamestown, and probably east of Jamestown, they're still, yeah, they still can benefit from it, but yeah, obviously this harvest has started in some areas, and yeah, the further west we go, it's going to have less effect, if not perhaps finish some of those crops off even quicker. So we've just been very lucky. It's, you know, our spring has been so cool.
How much difference has that made, the cool weather that's been seen across the state?
Oh, I think massive in that regard. Really, next week's probably the first lot of real hot weather we're perhaps looking at potentially.
Will that bring on harvest pretty quickly if the state does reach over 30 the way it's forecast at the moment?
Oh, it'll speed it up a bit, but it'll depend on what follows behind too.
And we had a caller earlier regarding frost affecting a crop near Bordertown. Have you had much frost effect?
Surprisingly, we seem to have dodged it fairly well through most of the area, though I understand sort of south of Spalding, down through there, they've been smacked pretty hard there late last week and early this week. So, yeah, not everywhere's been immune from it, for sure.
So what are your farmers' sentiments at the moment?
I guess frustrated on what the forecast was for especially September, but you know, yeah, again, the cool weather's certainly helped us limp along a lot further than we could have if we'd, you know, been smacked with typical warm weather. It just seems unusual to be still wearing jumpers and coats in the middle of October. We've certainly been different to that in other years. So, we've, you know, yeah, it hasn't been great, but it could have been worse for sure.
It really does. I just refuse to turn on the heater in October, but you've almost needed even a heater at some places. So,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
It's been remarkable. Well, thanks for your insight there. So a couple of mills around Jamestown.
I think they had three at Jamestown itself. So.
Yeah, righto. Thanks. That was Darren Peck with Elders at Jamestown there. If you've got some rainfall you'd like to let me know about, text me 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. It's 20 past 12.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
I'll head to the Riverland now, where not just the Riverland, but further down the river to the Coorong, where farmers, government officials, irrigators and scientists are actually circumnavigating the lower lakes and barrages today. The field trip is part of a two-day Murray-Darling Association stakeholder conference. The aim is to show the importance of the freshwater estuarine interactions for the health of the entire basin. MDA Vice President and Region 6 Chair Melissa Rebick says the excursion is being filmed so that upstream stakeholders stuck across borders can see some of the issues firsthand.
We'll also be going out to Parker Point, where we'll see the Southern Lagoon and the Northern Lagoon meet. The Southern Lagoon is primarily still very much not surviving or hasn't survived since the Millennium Drought, and the Northern Lagoon has recovered reasonably well since the Millennium Drought. And so that's a great place to be able to show stakeholders the issues that we're still dealing with and opportunities. We are filming the day. We were hoping to have our upstream regional chairs. So there's 12 regional chairs along the Murray-Darling Basin, which represents 178 odd councils along the Murray-Darling Basin. We're the voice for local government and locals, and we have great connections with state and federal government. Today we'll be continuing our discussions on from the symposium yesterday, where we'll formulate outcomes and suggestions and motions.
Murray-Darling Association Vice President and Region 6 Chair Melissa Rebick. Rosalie Orrick, General Manager of the Renmark Irrigation Trust, is also losing her voice amid the passionate conversations at the symposium. Ms. Orrick says sharing first-hand experiences and knowledge will help strengthen the Murray-Darling Basin Plan.
I have to say I'm very excited about going on the tour of the Lower Lakes and the barrages today. It's something I've been wanting to do for a while, and I think it's really important that everyone across the basin does familiarise themselves with the areas in the catchment. I'm from the Riverland, obviously, but we need to understand also what's happening down in the Lower Lakes area. And I think the more we can learn and the more information we share across the basin, the better outcome we'll get for the Murray-Darling Basin Plan and the basin and the health of the basin. The plan is the only plan we've got, and we need to make it work. Someone made a really good comment that even with respect to environmental water, it's really no different. The use of that efficiently is really no different to farmers using water efficiently on their farms. And I thought that was a really good observation. We also have learnt that the delivery agencies, the people that are responsible for getting water down through the system and including the environmental water, are all trying to work together really closely so that we get the best, I guess, triple bottom line outcomes and that we keep that connectivity in the river system.
So there's obviously a whole different number of viewpoints, people from quite a few other areas of the Murray-Darling Basin that couldn't join in person but were able to join online, and a lot of the forum will be shared. What are some of the takeaways that people in South Australia are really wanting to share with people on other parts of the basin?
All communities, all up and down the basin, when they start talking to each other, they have a lot of things to share. And certainly in South Australia, we have the experience with on-farm efficiency programs. If we didn't have that in South Australia, we would certainly not have returned as much water to the environment. And one of the region ones, so they're right up near where the lakes are, up in the upper storage area, they're actually talking about doing or considering doing the Alliance for Water Stewardship program, which recognises good water stewardship. Now, Renmark Irrigation Trust has done that program. program, and at the moment Remuera Council is undertaking that program. So it is a way, that program does make people think about the whole catchment, and I think the more people that could do that on the river system, it would be fantastic.
That was Renmark Irrigation Trust General Manager Rosalie Orrick, ending that report by Eliza Bellage. We'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now, where I'm joined by Senior Forecaster Brett Gage. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So there's a lot of disappointment around the state at the moment with the lack of rainfall. What's happened?
Oh, really? So some parts have actually done quite well. Over on the, especially on the west coast, but... I'm not sure all farmers want the rain right now, but they had 15 millimetres over at Minipa. Let's have a look here. Certainly out in the west, quite a lot. So Wirrala had 24, 15 at Minipa and Mount Cooper, 13 at Nundroo and 12 at Lock. So what's happened is the central parts have had less rainfall maybe than we've been expecting. Around the Mount Lofty Ranges, we've had 5 to 10. The Mid-North has had about 3 to 8. But that's right. A couple of days ago, we were forecasting more rainfall in the central areas. And the reason for that is that a couple of days ago, the models had a low south of Adelaide. But the low has gone more over Eyre Peninsula and up towards northern Spencer Gulf. So the models have changed on that, which has actually delivered higher rainfalls than we were expecting over the western parts of Eyre Peninsula, but generally slightly lower rainfalls elsewhere. But it's not done with yet. We are thinking a secondary low may develop near the southeast coast tonight. And we could get a good burst of showers going up the Mount Lofty Ranges tomorrow morning. And we could still get some reasonable shower and possible thunderstorm activity for the rest of today as well. Looking on the satellite picture, it's convecting over large parts of the state. So, and we're getting mixed messages from the farmers now. Some are saying a little bit more rain would be good. Others are saying they don't want it too much at this time of year, so that's interesting. But I think if we focus back on the warnings for today, we have had some damaging wind gusts at Thevenard earlier this morning. They had wind gusts of 93 kilometres per hour there, and we've still got a severe weather warning for the West Coast, Flinders, Northwest Pastoral, and the western parts of the Northeast Pastoral. Damaging wind gusts is possible, mostly with showers in that area today. Still got a sheep grazers warning for some western districts, western and central districts, and marine wind warnings for today. Still got a gale warning for the upper and lower west coast. Strong wind warning for the far west, central, south central coast and Spencer Gulf. So certainly the weather has been impacting those western parts more so than the central parts. But as I mentioned, there could be a bit of a burst going up central districts in the early hours of the morning. It all depends on where this next secondary low may form. It's a very complicated situation. There's various low centres stretched between our northern Spencer Gulf, right down to Tasmania. There's a few different low centres around the place. But as we move into tomorrow, as I mentioned, we've got a very high chance of showers going up the ranges in the early hours, and a high chance elsewhere about central and central parts of the agricultural area and eastern parts of the southern agricultural area. Otherwise, just a slight to medium chance of showers extending into the south of the pastoral districts. And later tomorrow, we'll see a high pressure system start to move into the Bight. And then it'll be in the Bight by Saturday morning, and we'll see showers and winds easing back further on Saturday. They'll pretty much just be about Gulf Coast and the southern agricultural area in the east. And then on Sunday, that high will move further eastwards to be over the eastern states. Still have a slight to medium chance of showers down in the lower southeast, and also a slight chance of showers developing in the far west.
That was Brett Gage with the Weather Bureau there, and welcome to the Country Hour. I am Cassie Huff, and we are going to be chatting soon about what is going on with getting Pacific Islanders vaccinated. There is a bit of a push on to get some of the itinerant workers at various locations across the state. I'll also be bringing you some information on the desalination plant in the far west of the state, down at Port Lincoln as well, on what's happening with that desalination plant as well. But I'll head across to news now with Wendy Glamatek.
Good afternoon, Cassie. In the news this hour, South Australia has the highest unemployment rate in the nation, but the state government says it isn't a major concern. 5.1% of South Australians were out of work in the month of September. That's a 1.1% increase on the August figure. Queensland was second worst, while the national rate edged up to 4.6% as the East Coast struggled through COVID lockdowns. Despite the state's high unemployment figure, the Skills Minister says the focus should be on other parts of the overall jobs figures. Police are yet to reveal how a woman died in her Pennington driveway in Adelaide's north. Her body was discovered lying under the rear of a car at her Addison Road home just after 7:30 this morning. The car's now been towed away and the woman's body's been removed from the scene. And New South Wales has surpassed over 70,000 coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic, with 406 new local cases and six more deaths in the latest reporting period. Police are investigating allegations, meanwhile, that a medical centre in Colac in Victoria has been handing out exemptions to those not wanting a COVID-19 vaccine. Officers yesterday shut down the clinic. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Wendy. Now, Victorian Ag is grappling with the COVID-19 vaccination deadline coming up tomorrow, but South Australia has yet to introduce a similar policy. Pacific Island Council of South Australia CEO Tukuni Tavui says only about 30 to 50% of the 1,000 seasonal workers in South Australia have had their first dose. That's significantly lower than the general population. Mr. Tavui told Eliza Ballage the council is working with SA Health and employers to get workers vaccinated by the end of the month.
Some of the employers have really taken the initiative and started engaging their local health provider, some of the local chemists, the local hospitals. The difficulty they're having is obviously when you've got some of these employers like Costa, Mayday Jobs Australia, really huge numbers, in the hundreds, 200, some of them are a bit over that. And so how do you get all those numbers, all those workers vaccinated at a reasonable pace without losing a lot of work, in terms of the business perspective? It's a difficult one because they obviously have to follow the same process as the rest of the public. So we are trying to work with SA Health on that. PICSA is working with SA Health to try and come up with some measure that will allow them to have a vaccination process a bit more smoother, but also in huge numbers, in big volumes. So a pop-up vaccination centres has been discussed with SA Health. So we're working on that slowly. But we're also working with the Department of Education, Skills and Employment, DESE, who oversees the seasonal worker program, to run a pilot in one of the local work sites in South Australia.
Can you tell me where that pilot program will be and
when it will
start?
We're looking at Port Lincoln now. We're just in the process of putting those structures together and how we will approach it. It's only a small number of workers, but that's managed by MADEC, and so we will work with MADEC and provide the support needed to engage those workers and get them vaccinated. There's about four countries that work in that particular. It's a tuna farm over in Port Lincoln. So one of the key components in getting the workers to participate in the vaccination program is they have to understand what it's about, and that requires content being presented to them in language, which is really a critical component of our approach. So we're probably working on, maybe by next week we'll have something in place in terms of how we'll approach it. Then we've only got a small number, which is a good thing, so we can get a good gauge and see what we've learned from there and then roll it out across the state.
And how much information and resources were PICSA finding that were already in language, and how much more work are you having to do to make sure that that information is relevant and accessible?
The Pacific labour scheme, which is the three-year visa under the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. They have a body that manages the whole program, the whole Pacific Labour Scheme, and they call the Pacific Labour Facility. It's really an arm of the company called Palladium, which won the contract from DFAT a couple of years ago. So they've actually got a lot of content being translated in language already. And so because of our connection with them, we're able to utilize that. But it does not substitute the importance of having conversation in language, because they will read, they will make sense of it, but they still have questions and they still, you know, want to be able to share how they feel about it, all that kind of stuff. So we still try and engage the actual physical conversation with them. But in terms of the language, the 10 countries that participate in this program, my understanding from our last conversation is that all the basic content of the vaccination program has been translated into language, 10 languages.
And how much in those conversations are you having to combat misinformation, perhaps shared amongst people or on social media?
That's right across. A lot of our work is because social media platform is really a great tool for them for communication, because it doesn't cost much, and they, you know, you just got to go to one of their cabins and they'll be talking for hours, 2 hours. You know, just family, everybody gets a chance to talk, and so it's quite readily available. But at the same platform is where they're getting a lot of information, and, you know, people forwarding articles that they find. And I mean, I saw some video on Facebook of one of the Pacific Island community. They're putting spoons on their shoulder where they've had the injection to say that it's got magnet components. And so you can see in the video the spoons tuck on their shoulders. And so you show that to the workers, good Lord, you know. They say, oh, no, this is not good. This is poisonous, all that kind of stuff. So misinformation is really rife, and we want to be able to counter that by providing some solid information, some evidence. And also, we've got a lot of Pacific Island doctors here in South Australia, so we're in the process as well of engaging them to be part of the conversation.
Pacific Island Council of South Australia CEO Tukini Tavui speaking with Eliza Balazs. And in a statement, Costa Group says the company will bus 150 of its Pacific Islander workers to the Berry vaccination hub to get their first jab in the next few weeks. So they're getting moving up there in terms of getting their staff vaccinated. And it won't happen too soon, because a lot of these deadlines are starting to crop up on the East Coast. I'll head to the waters now, because there is still concern about this proposed desalination plant at Boston Bay near Port Lincoln. Members of the fishing community, tourism operators and recreational fishers held a raft-up protest at the site yesterday. The state government has proposed a desal plant for Billy Lights Point, and is meant to provide long-term water security to the region. However, tuna baron Hagen Steer says he's worried that saline discharge from the plant would pollute the waters and harm the local aquaculture and fishing.
Well, in the past I didn't sort of worry very much about it, but now I seem to be coming closer. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's ridiculous what happened. To have a bunch of public servants making decisions for us, for an industry, which when I first came to this country 55 years ago, there was nothing here. Now we got a major export sector in regards to tuna and kingfish, and to be able that anyone could put that in jeopardy is just it's mind-blowing, actually. It ought to be stopped forthwith, not if and buts. And if the government keeps on going down this line, there will be severe consequences in the future when the next election is going to come up, because this can't keep on going. We are a major industry sector. And I say it lightly, we got kingfish 6,000 tons a year. They want to get up to 10,000 tons. The tuna industry is close to 9,000 or 9,500 tons. That's just two industry sectors. And they want to, you're blowing it all up. What for? We had major tuna kills many, many years ago, you know, because of the bad water movements in here, and now they want to put a desalination plant. I mean, it defies my imagination that things like that, even that we have to sit here, that we have to make an interview about stuff like that, which should not happen.
Tuna Baron Hagen Steer speaking with Evelyn Leckie. Senator Rex Patrick says SA Water needs to look at another site.
On the face of it, it seems to me as though this isn't the right site. It's got too much industry around it in terms of fishing industry. It doesn't seem to have the flows necessary to clear discharge or indeed to allow the intakes to operate without interfering with the local fishing industry. I think it's likely being selected for convenience and for cost. That's not the right approach here. We've got to do this sensibly, properly, looking at the issue on the merits.
Senator Rex Patrick speaking there, and in a statement to the ABC, SA Water says it acknowledges the concerns of the local aquaculture industry. It said the business had assessed 20 sites around Port Lincoln and lower parts of the Eyre Peninsula for the plant, and that the site at Billy Lights Point had firmed up as the preferred option. A spokesperson said the independent oceanographic modelling showed that any saline concentrate would be adequately diffused and that the flushing rate of the bays was many times greater than that the plant would produce or could produce. So they haven't made a decision definitely, but as they're saying there, it does seem like this site that has raised some concerns for the local fishing industry, tourism operators, fishers around that area. The site at Billy Lights Point is firming up as the preferred option. And if you have been concerned about this, text me 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. Some good news, though, for South Australia's bluefin tuna fishery, at least, is that it's not overfished for the first time in the history of the federal government's fishery status report. The report assessed 100 fish stocks across 22 fisheries managed by the Commonwealth government, with 77 stocks not classified as subject to overfishing. However, ABARES scientist Dr. Heather Patterson says one of the challenges of the report was measuring stocks that are overfished.
Well, we flagged in the report that one of the biggest challenges is where you have an overfished stock. So we have this really great policy, the Commonwealth Fisheries Harvest Strategy Policy, and that says that when you have an overfished domestic stock, you stop targeted fishing because that's what you want, right? You want to stop fishing a stock that's been overfished. But when you do that, you also cut off the data supply because that's where you're getting the main data from, the catch and effort from the commercial fishery. So this is a problem for fisheries around the world, not just Australia. And it's certainly a problem that AFMA, the Australian Fisheries Management Authority that manages Australian government managed stocks, is aware of. And they're working on ways to get around it. And for instance, one of the ways to get around it is to look for alternative data series. An example of an alternative data series would be something like close kin mark recapture, which is a genomic technique that CSIRO has developed and that's been applied to a few fisheries. So it is a problem, but definitely a recognized problem. And like I said, AFMA is working on ways around that.
And you've mentioned, close kin microcapture a couple times. Just could you explain for those who are not familiar, what is that?
So the idea with close kin mark recapture is the analogy CSIRO often give is if you go to a small town and you genetically sample two people you just find randomly on the street, the chances of those people being related are much greater than if you went to a big city and do the same thing. So if you have a very small population, you find a lot of individuals that are related. If you have a larger population, you find less individuals that are related. And so we can apply that to animal populations and fish populations. So that's one way to get information about the size of a stock without having a commercial fishery. And that technique has been applied in the southern bluefin tuna fishery, where we can use that to calculate an abundance of the stock.
And speaking of the southern bluefin tuna fishery, it is now no longer classified as overfished. So, would you mind telling me, I suppose, what is the state of that fishery?
Well, that stock is now classified as not overfished and not subject to overfishing, which is the first time that's happened in the history of the status report. So that's a really good outcome for the stock.
What sort of is the state of overfishing in Australia's fish stocks at the moment, according to this report?
Well, this report only looks at fish stocks that are managed by the Australian government, and doesn't look at state-managed stocks at all. And in this report, we assess 100 stocks this year, just from fisheries managed by the Australian government. And of those 100 stocks, 66 were classified as both not overfished and not subject to overfishing. So that's a pretty good outcome. So, you know, you have two-thirds of the stocks classified what we would call green, not overfished and not subject to overfishing. So that's good. And there's only a single stock that's classified as both overfished and subject to overfishing. But that's a stock that's managed jointly as part of an international organization.
ABARES scientist Dr. Heather Patterson speaking with Lucas Forbes. It's 1:45.
New from ABC Books.
Step into Costa's World, a gorgeously illustrated gardening guide for the whole family by much-loved ABC presenter Costa Georgiadis. Share his passion and knowledge of sustainability and community with practical tips on his favourite plants, the joy of chooks, easy-peasy permaculture, and so much more.
There's something to tickle everyone's fancy.
Costa's World, available now in bookshops and online.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, the next story I have is not really for anyone who gets a bit squeamish about things like popping pimples. It has gained quite a following online, though, this story, thanks to the pimple-popping community in the United States. An enterprising vet from Western Australia's Esperance region is using social media to bridge the gap between the city and the country. And again, as I said, this is not for the faint-hearted if you don't like anything to do with pus, but as Tara de Landgraaf reports, his videos are proving so popular they're now a handy little money earner.
Dr. Enoch Bergman has been a vet for over 2 decades. Originally hailing from Colorado in the US, he now calls WA's southeast coast home. And his expertise in large animals, especially cattle, has made him infamous in farming circles around the state. But he's now gathering quite the following online as well, with his YouTube channel having close to 50,000 subscribers.
If I get students like Carl come down and they'd be in the rocket with me driving around and we'd be doing something kind of neat, and they go, oh, you should video that and put it on YouTube. And I was like, oh, yeah. And then my son Eli, you've got an Eli as well, he was into me, Dad, I want to be a YouTuber. And I was like, oh, yeah. Dad. And you know, it is with kids, like, on the weekend, I'll look into it. So it's still at me. So I tried to set him up a YouTube channel, but because he's a minor, it was just a mess, you know, because obviously we protect our young from that sort of environment. And I was like, this isn't actually that difficult. So I just Enoch the cow vet, and I just flicked up a video, and it just kind of grumbled along, and I put it on Facebook, and a couple friends had a laugh, and then the pimple popper crowd in the U.S. got a hold of it, and it went viral, it went ballistic. Yeah, it said 3.6 million hits. I suddenly realized, people were like, man, you could be monetized. I said, what the hell does that mean? I said, well, you can get paid. I said, really? And I said, yeah. So I looked into it, I became monetized, and now someone else is buying the iced coffees for my clients. It's awesome. It's ridiculous. It's just madness.
Enoch's a vet full-time as well as a farmer in his own right. And while his YouTube channel started out as a way to educate students, as he mentioned, it's also gathered the attention of the pimple-popping community during COVID.
Well, what people want and what I post are quite different. Although sometimes they align. It's kind of like a big Venn diagram. So pretty much when I'm doing stuff and something's cool and I think if a student can learn from it or even another veterinarian or a lot of stuff's producer directed, like, you know, how to tube feed a calf, bits and pieces like that, versus other stuff's, you know, veterinary student, like, you know, how to remove a cancer eye or how to preg test a cow, et cetera. So I try to do whatever I'm doing. I'll be, hey, would you mind holding my camera and videoing this? And then I'll get home and just upload it. It's pretty simple. And I don't do any editing. I just toss it up there. And but the ones that people like appears to be pus. It's very much a pus-driven economy. So if you've got an abscess out there, you farmers in Esperance, call me on the weekend. I'll come and lance it for free. It's just madness. It's ridiculous. These people, what it is the pimple popper thing, I think it just got to the point where they're like, they'd seen that many zits getting popped on people that they'd kind of like running out of rope. You know, like, how much more can you do? And then they went, oh my God, look what you can do with a cow. Because cows have really thick skin and they have a really hyper-reactive immune system. So when they get a zit, it goes DEFCON 1. And man, these pimple popper guys, they just, some of them, you read the comments and some of them are like, I just keep watching it over and over and over again. Anyway, every time they watch it, I get 0.2 cents, and 3.6 million people watch a video. You do the maths.
For vet student Kyle Smith, the chance to shadow Enoch was an opportunity not to be missed. And he says having the YouTube channel to refer back to is invaluable.
So yeah, Enoch's pretty notorious up at Murdoch. We all know him pretty well. You know, even before the YouTube channel really took off, he's always been, and Swans in general have been a prac that most people have been really keen to do, especially in final year. You know, you get to come down here and do some stuff that really prepares you for the industry, especially if you want to get into mixed practice or production medicine.
So you've obviously checked out the YouTube stuff. I mean, is it handy for these students?
Heck yeah. So there's a lot of stuff on there that you may not see while you're on prac. Our pracs tend to be 2, 3, 4 weeks max at a clinic. And, you know, that might fall in a certain season where you might see, you know, a heap of vaginal prolapses, or you might see a heap of uterine prolapses, or you might do a heap of pregnancy. But you might not get to see a very wide range of things because you're only there for a short amount of time. So having that YouTube channel, something to refer back to when you go out into practice and something to learn from as well when you're a student is great.
For Enoch, dealing with the potential trolls or animal rights activists online was difficult at first, but he believes it's all for the good of the industry to show exactly what goes on in the field and potentially help in animal welfare situations right around the world.
I want people that don't live on the land, because that's becoming more and more common, to kind of just see what we do out there. And admittedly, some of the stuff I do might make people go, oh my God, what are these guys doing? But it's just everyday stuff that I do, and they can see that I'm having fun. Sometimes I get a comment of like, oh, how can you be so cavalier and joking around these animals? I say, look, they don't really know what I'm saying, and they respond to my mood. So I'm going to keep having fun. If I get all serious and grumbly, they're going to sense that as well. So I just have fun. And some people, must be very religious countries, say, oh, God bless you for helping these animals. And that makes me feel good. Every now and again you get a troll, but I just give them a polite response and then go, goodbye.
You mentioned the trolls, but I mean, do you worry about, you know, animal activists and that kind of thing as well, Enoch?
You get people that are obviously from their comments are aligned that way. And like I've had other people say, wow, you're just so polite. And I reckon that's the way we ought to be. The worst thing we can do is get angry at someone who's trying to make us angry. I mean, an activist is trying to make you angry, you know. And I do feel sorry for those people because they don't really understand that what we're doing. We love these animals more than they can even comprehend. They want to love them, but they don't have a connection. They don't know how. So they're trying to do it the best way they know how, and whether that's painting themselves up with red paint and walking into a crowd of people at the Royal Show. Whatever it is they're trying to do, they've got the right heart, but they got the wrong idea. And whenever I do meet an activist, I say, you need to come ride with me in my ute for a week. I said, look, I'll introduce you to a hell of a lot of good people that love their animals more than you can even imagine. And that's what we're not communicating well. And by getting angry, we can't communicate it at all.
You do have viewers who are outside of Australia and perhaps from some of those third world countries.
Yeah,
I mean,
a lot of India and all sorts of places.
Are you worried people might try and look at what you're teaching the vet students and try things themselves?
Initially I thought about that a bit, but then I thought, well, if people are in a world where they don't have access to veterinary care, at least if they watch mine, maybe they'll go about things the best that they can, and that might equal a better welfare outcome than not doing anything at all. But I'm also hoping that people that watch the videos that do have access to veterinarians are like, hey, wow, this guy's got some interesting ideas. I need a relationship with my veterinarian. Absolutely, I've been trying to talk every vet I know into doing what I'm doing. I'm like, dude, this is awesome, you need to do it. Some people say, oh, you can retire from being a vet. I say, well, the success of the channel is predicated on me being a veterinarian, so it's probably going to keep me trapped in the role of the local veterinarian. But I don't work for a living, I just spend time with my friends, and this YouTube channel is just another aspect of that. And yeah, we'll see what I do with it. Like I say, my wife said, hey, let's go get a remote control car for Louie. So I went and bought a nice remote control car. She goes, oh, that looks a bit expensive. I said, YouTube, baby, YouTube. So I just probably bling it a little bit more. I kicked to bring out more iced coffees. I brought out 6 iced coffees for the crew today. It's a big crew. Yeah, I don't worry so much about the little nickel and dime stuff that I might have used to, is kind of what I'm spending on. Because I'm on track to do about 60 grand a year, which is ridiculous.
That is crazy for popping pimples. That was Dr. Enoch Bergman, a vet and farmer from Esperance in Western Australia. You can go to abc.net.au to see that story, or just search for Enoch the Cow Vet as well on YouTube to check those videos out if you are now suitably intrigued. Finally today, it's the age-old dilemma, parents trying to get their children to eat veggies. It's something that farmer Catherine Valicia and teacher Mark Pullen at Veg Education are trying to solve by talking to primary school students about where their veggies come from and their value. Eden Hennan has this story.
How do you, like, grow the lettuce after you've got it out? How do you continue growing them after? Because there's no seeds.
What do you do when, like, your vegetables aren't able to go in the shops?
Is it very hard to make the vegetables perfect?
While online learning keeps students indoors, inquisitive young minds are thinking about what's going on outside. Catherine Valicia and Mark Pullen usually visit schools across the state to teach students all about where their veggies come from. But during COVID-19, they've moved classes online.
We try to make it really easy for teachers to choose our program. It aligns well with their needs, but we also think it's really important about opening up a conversation and showing children, A, where their food comes from, B, the supply chain in all its aspects, and C, the kind of opportunities and job roles and positions that there are in our industry. So it's our way to engage directly to the consumers of now and the future, but also our potential workforces.
We're looking for a good zucchini, nice shiny skin, heavy for weight. But the one thing I do want to ask you to think about when you're in the shop and you look at the zucchinis, why are they all one size? Why do they always have to be one size? Does that make it different for you? And these are things we need to start asking ourselves when we shop, because these are the things that make it very difficult being a farmer. Some of these expectations about what something should look like, the size it should be and the colour it should be.
I think the important thing for young people is to, as Kirsten said, really understand where their fresh produce comes from. I don't think there's any understanding really of the supply chain and what it takes. And what we're really focusing on is trying to change the conversation around fresh produce. So in the past, what we've seen in a range of different marketing campaigns about eating more fruit and veggies and things like that has always, we believe, focused on the negative aspect, as in, how do you hide the vegetables? How do you make it so the kids don't even know they're eating vegetables? So we're trying to change that conversation into they're actually delicious. And the thing is, you need to cook them and respect them the same as you would with your proteins. And if you cook vegetables well, then they taste fantastic. And it shouldn't be about having to hide or trick kids into getting their vegetable intake increased.
Having your veggie break, we've had some cucumber that's really good as a snack, celery, fantastic snack, really, really good. And there's a thing that you can do, and you can do this at home for those that are allowed to eat different things at home. So you get your celery, and then in the middle of the celery, you can put cream cheese, but you put peanut butter, that's really good. And then you sprinkle some sultanas on top, and it's called ants on a log, and it's delicious, really good.
What's been a favourite question you've received from one of the children?
I think it's an interesting one. We had one today where one lad said asked the question, if something gets rejected, can you fix it? And then, look, you know, and it was sort of like, well, you know, it grows in the ground, and once it's out of the ground, that's it, it is what it is. It's sort of... it's just a different shape, you know, and it's not about fixing it necessarily.
I think what we try to, you know, really, if there is that disconnect between products. So, you know, we do, like cauliflowers, we explain to them how we keep them white. So, you know, there's someone walking around in the paddock who actually breaks the leaves and puts them on his hat, you know, and that really is, that's true. And that really, then the next time you walk into a store and you see a cauliflower when it's been 40 degrees in the middle of January for a week, that reverence now for that product itself, but also the people that have grown it, that really has changed a little bit. And hopefully through that, that also changes the consumption of that vegetable.
Farmer Catherine Valicia and teacher Mark Pullen at Veg Education speaking there with Eden Henninen. Sonia Feldhoff's got a lot more to come though. Hi, Sonia.
We have indeed. And in fact, last week we heard the police commissioner say he'd ordered SA Health to review the city today. Will it get another day? You might get an answer this afternoon.
Keep listening. If you're keen on the city debate, I'm not going to be partaking. But to all of you who are, I wish you luck. That's all we have time for, though, in the program. It's coming up to 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.